Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 14th, 1998. In the Creekside room this morning is Anna Maria Pineda. Today's session number is 98-2, and it's titled, The Practice of Home Altars in the Hispanic Community. Let's listen in.
So they can restart the tape.
That's right.
I introduced myself yesterday, but it probably would be good to do it again. I'm Anna Maria Pineda. I think I said a little bit about myself yesterday. I don't know if I mentioned that I originally was from Central America. I was born in Salvador and came to the States when I was 2 years old. I think that was part of my introduction. And it's been a very important part of my life. I belong to a very vibrant Hispanic community, and to be part of a household where to be Hispanic was very important and very valued. And the history and the traditions that my parents brought to this country was what nourished us in the household. I have three brothers. The reason I always pause is because the youngest one came rather late. He was like the last blessing to the family. So it's three brothers and a sister. And today we're going to talk about home altars, which is part of the tradition in many Hispanic households, not every household, but in many. And what it basically is the setting aside of space within the home so that God, in a very intentional way, can be present to those of the household. For many of us, we associate sacred space with a church, with a place of worship, and indeed it is sacred space. And in the church, we have the altar, which seems to provide the place within that space where God manifests himself through ritual. Well, in the home, in many Hispanic households, the home altar serves that same purpose. It is the place where the divine reveals the sacredness of the mystery of God to those in the household. And it is the place where intentionally you kind of turn your gaze, you turn your attention, you turn moments of prayer and meditation toward that space. In a general way, in the Latino or Hispanic household, the kitchen is also a sacred place. It's the place where good conversation takes place, where relationships are cemented and bonded, where people who enter a home oftentimes as just perhaps friendly acquaintances become very intimate members of that household. But while that is true, it's also true to say that what one does in a Hispanic household is find perhaps a niche in the home where you can place the home altar. So it's not just the sacred space of the kitchen, but also the very intentional sacred place of where the home altar is. And there is a variety of ways that it can manifest itself within the Hispanic household. It can be a little nook, a little corner of your bedroom or the living room or even the kitchen or the porch or any place that where you want it to be. And it could be anything as simple as having a statue of a Mary or a cross or a picture of the Sacred Heart. Sometimes adorned with flowers, oftentimes with a candle by its side. Although today when we're in a fire-conscious society, we can't always have a candle. It has to be when you're present at home. But what all of this does is they're symbols to help us be intimately involved with God, to establish a relationship of friend, of companion, of counselor, and the saints as well. And the saints take on a very personal relationship with you, so much so that sometimes in your pleading or petition prayer, if your prayers and your requests aren't met, sometimes there's symbolic ways where you turn the statue around and have it face the wall until it does answer your prayers. And that is not unusual. I don't know if many of you are familiar with the book Rain of Gold. It's I was mentioning it last night to Mark and a gathering of other colleagues here. The Rain of Gold is a wonderful story of Victor Villaseñor's family on his mother's side. And he traces it back all the way to Mexico. But from Mexico, they cross the border, they come into the U.S. And there's a wonderful part of the book where the grandmother, Doña Margarita, is pleading for a lost son who was lost as they were crossing the border. And she would go to church every single day and would kneel before the statue of Mary and pray to her, and pray to her as a mother. And she would do this faithfully every single day. And these conversations would be at great length. Sometimes she would go in and tell Mary jokes, and they would kind of share laughter back and forth. And it's a very vivid exchange, a very intimate exchange. But one day, after many years of this kind of going in and petitioning the return of her son, she finally has had it. And she goes in and says to her, okay, today we're going to have a conversation, woman to woman, mother to mother, because you are a mother and you know what it's like to have lost a son. And you tell Jesus to please stay out of this conversation, because this is no place for him to be. We have to understand each other because we both are women, we both are mothers. And she goes on and scolds Mary and tells her, how many years have I come to ask you for this favor, and you haven't done it? Well, I'm tired of waiting. I don't care what you do. I don't care if you bring him back dead or alive, but I want my son back. So please see to it that it gets done. In the meantime, the parish younger associate priest comes over, and here's this little wrinkled up little lady screaming at the statue, at Mary. And fearful for his life and fearful for what could happen. She's blaspheming. She's insulting the presence of Mary. So he runs to the rectory and tells the pastor, he's an older man, please come to the church. There's something terrible going on, terrible. So the older man runs to the church and he sees Doña Margarita, and he says to the young man, don't worry, she comes in every day. There's no problem. She's just praying. She's just talking to Mary. So it's that kind of relationship that often gets developed, so that there's a real familiarity and a real intimacy talking to God and talking to the saints. What are some of the activities that would take place by those who practice the practice of having a home altar? Well, you go in to ask for your human needs. You might want your restoration of health. Maybe you've been ill. Maybe there's a member of the family who is ill. Maybe there's a friend. So you turn your gaze toward the altar to ask for health. Or you might be awaiting the birth of a child, and perhaps you're worried that it might be a difficult pregnancy for a daughter-in-law, for yourself, for a friend, for a family member. And that also becomes a prayer, a petition. You might be asking for employment. You might be asking for many needs that you are experiencing, either as an individual or as a family or as a community, as a neighborhood, as a member of a worshiping community. In my neighborhood in San Francisco, for example, not too long ago, the church, which is like 120 years old, burnt. And it was a terrible loss. After having lost the pastor to cancer, lost the associate to a sudden heart attack, lost a very beloved member of the community to a sudden heart attack. And so these prayers and petitions, as you can imagine, were probably being repeated in household after household, you know, within the neighborhood. And then, of course, it's also a place where you give thanks. You give thanks for just the opportunity to wake up and have another morning, to have the beauty of a home and village, to have the joy of a granddaughter being brought into the family, or the return of a member of the family who's been alienated. So you give thanks. I remember my father sometimes, I'd just sitting at the kitchen table, and he would look very lost in thought. And I would say, you know, Papa, what are you thinking about? He says, Hija, I'm just giving thanks to God because God has been so good. So many favors, none of them which I have deserved. So it is also a place where you do that, you know, to give thanks. Just the way the home altar is the manifestation of the divine presence within the home, we also find that it's rooted in scripture. It actually has a rootedness in scripture. And what I'm going to share with you is also the work of a Mexican-American scripture scholar. I'm not a scripture scholar. I'm reflecting a lot upon what he's written with regard to home altars. and the relationship to scripture. His name is Gilbert Romero. He's in a lovely piece where he puts together a lot of the devotional practices of Hispanics, and this particular one is on the home altar. Gilberto or Gilbert Romero would say that in scriptures, particularly in the Old Testament, you find two ways in which Yahweh is present. He is present in the tent of meeting, the tent of meeting. A tent of meeting which emerges during the time of Israel's wandering in the wilderness under the leadership of Moses. And there is a place here in the Old Testament in the book of Exodus which gives us an idea of the tent of meeting. The tent of the Lord's presence. Whenever the people of Israel set up camp, Moses would take the sacred tent and put it up some distance outside the camp. It was called the tent of the Lord's presence, and anyone who wanted to consult the Lord would go out to it. Whenever Moses went out there, the people would stand at the door of their tents and watch Moses until he entered it. After Moses had gone in, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the door of the tent, and the Lord would speak to Moses from the cloud. As soon as the people saw the pillar of cloud at the door of the tent, they would bow down. The Lord would speak with Moses face to face, just as a man speaks with a friend. Then Moses would return to the camp. But the young man who was his helper, Joshua, son of Nun, stayed in the tent. This particular reading indicates to us that Yahweh is present among his people, that a tent of meeting is established or set up, and that's where Yahweh reveals or communicates with Moses. It's through Moses, however, that the communication takes place. And so what we have is a relationship of Yahweh with his people, but a transcendent relationship. There's not really a direct relationship. They go, but it is Moses who enters the tent, and it's Moses who talks to him face to face as a friend, as with a friend. So this is like one tradition of the tent of meeting. The second tradition that Gilberto Romero talks about is the manifestation of Yahweh as is found in the tradition of the Ark of the Covenant. And in the Ark of the Covenant, we find there's many readings, but one is from the Book of Numbers. Let me just locate it. The people set out. When the people left Sinai, the holy mountain, they traveled 3 days. The Lord's covenant box also went ahead of them to find a place for them to camp. As they moved on from each camp, the cloud of the Lord was over them by day. Whenever the covenant box started out, Moses would say, "Arise, Lord, scatter your enemies and put to flight those who hate you." And whenever it stopped, he would say, "Return, Lord, to the thousands of families of Israel." In this second tradition of the Ark of the Covenant, God is present Yahweh is present in a different way. It's more of an imminence. It's more directly related and intervenes with people's regular activities and the needs of the community. First, it provides an extension or an embodiment of the presence of God. God is present, Yahweh is present within the Ark of the Covenant. And it's portable, so that the portable symbol of God accompanies them, but also is a protection during war or during battle. God is with them in a very portable manner. He accompanies them. It's not pitched in a very permanent manner. And within that, you have the two tablets of the Decalogue, which is also carried. And it's a portable throne for the invisible presence of God. If we look at these two traditions, that of the Tent of Meeting and the Ark of the Covenant, one is transcendent, the transcendent presence of God, and the other one is the imminent presence of God. The one that most closely relates to the home altar would be the second. It's the Ark of the Covenant. The practice of the home altar where people have direct access to God, where God's presence is directly made manifest to the people of that household. And the home altar can be the equivalent of the sacred shrine or the holy mountain where God's presence is invoked. There is a place where there's a mutual exchange of responsibility and commitment, where favors are requested and favors are granted. Where Hispanics that are in need of God's protection, that find themselves feeling very vulnerable, feeling very unprotected, as in battle, if you will, can ask God for healing, for protection from exploitation in the marketplace, or oppression, personal problems, the sense of not having power in a society where it's dominantly other, where perhaps the members of that community feel marginalized, beset by many of the restrictions of a society which isn't really their home. So you have this experience occurring. But also the home altar serves not only as a place of God's presence, but also as a place where you can recall stories of salvation, or stories of redemption, or stories of healing. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is you are constantly reminded of favors asked for and favors granted. And so it becomes a place where storytelling takes place. And it's a storytelling that involves the family, the children, the older members, so that someone could say, well, when your mother was expecting you, we were worried. And we prayed to Saint Martin de Porres, or to Mary, or to Jesus, or to whatever the favorite saint, or the or God under a particular title, Jesus. And you came to us as a blessing, and you came to us healthy. Or when you were small, there was an accident, and we prayed for your healing. Or your father was out of work, and we prayed. And my father tells the story. He said that one time, when we first came to this country, he was the only one working, and he was just waiting for the next payday. And my older brother, who was quite active, ran outside and was playing around and came home, minus one shoe. Well, that was his only pair of shoes. And my father thought, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? Payday is away, still a week away. I don't have anything to use to buy this child another pair of shoes, and he can go to school and do all the things you need to do. And he said, I was praying and just asking for God's help. And in the mail that afternoon, I got a letter from a friend I hadn't heard of in years. And apparently I had loaned him some money years ago. And wouldn't you know that in that letter comes this check, repaying the debt. And that was what I needed. And that was a prayer asked for, a request, and a request granted. And those are the stories that we grew up with, the telling of stories, and the reminder constantly that God is present to us, that God is within our fingertips, that God is in our home, that God is in the workplace, that God is every place. But in a very intentional way, this becomes a focal point where these kinds of stories of God's intervention and God's mercy and God's compassion can take place. The other wonderful thing about the home altar is that you don't even need to talk early. Sometimes all you have to do is turn your gaze toward it, and it becomes like a silent moment of contemplation or meditation or prayer. And there is this communication that's going on, and no words are necessary. There's nothing that needs to be said or needs to be spoken. So I think in terms of the home altar, that is what occurs in the Latino community generally. But I also think that many of us do have these kind of sacred spaces within our homes, or spaces where we have things that are of importance to us, that express the value of the family, but we don't often think about it. And so what I want to do is just kind of open it up now and just have us maybe reflect or share what other ways can the idea of a home altar be experienced, perhaps in your own homes, perhaps in the homes of people that you know, perhaps the home altar, which seems to be very permanently established within the Latino community and within the homes of those who practice it, this is not the only form. Maybe there are other forms that are coming alive, but that basically does the same thing for us. Gives us access to God's presence, reminds us of God's presence, makes us conscious and attentive to God and to the sacredness of that presence among us. So,
I wanted to share two things. I grew up in Brazil, even though I fall into the title of Hispanic, you know, I have very little Spain English. We speak Portuguese, and I am also native Brazilian from the Tambiba tribe. But in my family, our altars had many pictures, and these were primarily our ancestors, the family members that had died. And also when somebody was sick, like if there was a cousin who, I had a cousin who died of meningitis when I was little, and I remember his picture on that altar, and that was to remind us every day when we said grace at dinner, there was we have to think and give our good thoughts to this person to get well. Well, he was sick for many years and he eventually died, but he had his picture still in the altar in my parents' house in Brazil. And when I came to live in the Southwest United States, where I live now in Arizona, and home altars is a large tradition in Arizona, in New Mexico, in Northern Mexico, everybody has one. And I learned something that's totally beautiful, which is around Dia de los Muertos, which is the Day of the Dead that's celebrated. Not only they have the pictures of the deceased ones, but they decorated with paper flowers and food. And that was something that was a total new concept to me, was to have that night of All Souls Day. The dead is invited to have meaning with the living by eating their favorite foods, and they prepare the favorite foods and they put it in the altar. That's one thing I wanted to share. The other thing I wanted to share is, like, 10 years ago, we were fortunate enough to go live in Japan and subsequently travel to most of Asia, where we lived in Indonesia and Thailand and Japan. And all those countries, they are not Christian, Buddhist, Christian, totally different. They have altars. The Japanese have the Shinto altars in every corner of Japan, little crooked streets in our neighborhood where we lived in Fukasa, out of Kyoto. There would be a corner, and every day there would be fresh flowers in that little corner. There would be candles that had just been lit, and I'd go by and see that the candle had just finished, and the next time I go by, there was a new candle in there. And it was amazing. And the same for Thailand and Indonesia. In Indonesia, every house has an ancestor altar, and that's where they cremate the people, and their ashes are neatly arranged in urns inside their home altars. And that's also something, it was so amazing, because to me the idea of altars was always very home and very private and very culturally bound. But then when I went to Asia, I realized that this is a worldwide issue, that everybody had an altar. The Indonesians go to great extent to celebrate their altars. I mean, their home, the focus of their house, unlike ours, which is a kitchen, or even here in America, the kitchen or the living room with the television, over there, the focus of their compound is their ancestor altar. And it's built of stone, elaborately carved, and every year, or every feast, you know, their calendar is different from ours. Their days, their years, only 270 days long. So every time the new year comes, they have to make new decorations for the altar to remember all the ancestors. And it just gave me a whole perspective that this is not just us, but it's mostly part of a human nature, a deeper, you know, that binds us all, because the Japanese are so exclusive, and yet they have altars just like we do. And it was so amazing because I felt such a foreigner there, so a total stranger. I could never blend in there. But in every corner there was a Shinto altar, and they offered candles, they offered money, the coins all over. Nobody ever took the coins, you know, went to charity. Somebody would come pick it up and take it. But there would be money thrown to the Shinto altar, then flowers and candles, just like ours.
Can you think of other expressions of a kind of a home altar that takes place in people's homes? or outside of it, and that's just for people's homes.
We were given a head of Christ, one of ours traveled to Israel and had purchased a head of Christ made out of olive oil. And so it has the beautiful grain, dark grain. It's the head of Christ with the horns. And it's a very meaningful statue for me. Particularly when I'm hurting.
Do you feel a company by the presence of that suffering Christ and the comfort of that presence?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Prayer wheels.
Yes. Say a little bit about
prayer wheels. I don't really know that much about them. I know when you know, like in Tibet, like when you walk by them, you spin them. But I don't know.
Growing up in the Chicago area, you knew if you were visiting somebody who was Jewish because of the, you know, from Deuteronomy, you know, these shall be on your gates.
Yes.
The Deuteronomy 6 and maybe the Decalogue is rolled up on a little scroll. The Thuzi, I think it's modern.
Yes.
But it's touched when you come and go. And it's in the doorpost, you know. And so in Chicago area, oh, hey, these folks are Jewish, you know, and you know they have a little, you know, remembrance. Maybe not so much about, it is in a very, very brief way a portable home altar, because when the people move, they try to take that with them and put it up in their new home.
And so it's a reminder, you touch it, you go in.
My dad was a carpenter, you know, and somebody who was of a different tradition, he said one time he had to repair the door frame because the previous folks who owned the home were Jewish, and when they pulled it out, they came home. You know, always, what'd you do today? Well, I repaired some Methuzi damage. And then he had to ask him what that meant, you know. And he told us what it was, you know. And sure enough, I was observant to that when you go to people's homes that served in part.
Yes. I mean, I think every culture, you know, has that, like, human need, but how do we do it?
Mm-hmm.
And this is just one expression. It's not the only expression.
Mm-hmm.
I think paintings too. We were given a painting, you know, it's the traditional man, you know, offering grace, you know, on a very simple, the very simple bowl, the loaf of bread, the scriptures are open, his glasses are laying there on the table. It's been reproduced many, many times. I suppose for some folks in the Northern European tradition, Werner Solomon, who was popular in the 40s, you know, their understanding, their picture of Christ is captured by what he painted. And yet, you know, I always have to tell people that they should allow permission to others to see Christ as something other than Solomon's head of Christ, because that's very culturally defined and narrow.
Mm-hmm.
But every culture is kind of a narrow slice and should have permission to paint Jesus as they see him. And it's usually in a prominent place in people's homes.
And when you look at that painting, are there thoughts or can you share some of those? What kind of comes to you?
Well, I grew up in a predominantly German-American community, and so that was the standard by which you saw Jesus. You know, that when somebody died and the memorial money was given, you know, there would be somewhere prominent in the church, Solomon's head of Christ, and you'd go backlit or with the light on top of it, so you knew it was prominent when you went into church. It was there, and then, of course, you connect it with the liturgy and the hymns and prayers. And, you know, it's in the mix of things, so it's always going to be a part of your
consciousness.
And as you think of when you pray, whether you even like the picture or not, because it's not it's not my favorite. It comes and visits me, you know, because it's part of my youth. You know, and again, you know, training up children in the youth, the things we provide for our children, they'll rebel against them and maybe say horrible things about them in adolescence, and yet. If they're honest, years later, they say, I remember the painting.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm thinking of a practice that Luther admonishes us to do, which is when you wash your face in the morning to remember your baptism. So it's not a special place. I mean, it's there you are. You're washing your face. It's the water. It's the mirror. It's just the soap and, you know, whatever is there, the ordinary thing. But it's the practice and the remembrance that transforms that fits very well, of course, with his view of how water and the word work together. But you could think of that as analogous, I think, to a home altar.
Mm-hmm.
rather than setting something apart, to make use of something that's ordinary. And in our bathroom, we have all these shells, the sort of shell that is a baptismal symbol there, as sort of to prompt that remembrance.
So you actually have a little prompter altar.
Well, yeah,
Your bathroom.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tile on the wall and a soap dish, but yeah.
In many homes, it's a picture, a faded picture.
Yeah.
In a corner that serves as a little. I'm using the word home altar in
a very general way.
Sense.
And I have that in my office. There's a painting by a Norwegian genre painter, which is looking from the, as if the painter is at the altar in the congregation, and a woman is carrying a child in. It's called Before the Baptism. So this, see this baby being brought in, which I have in my office to before I go to class to say, now, where did you get this job?
And where do you
know? To whom are you responsible for this job?
Where do you put your where do you direct your gaze or your glance?
Oh, to be the child. You know, that I am the one who's been baptized. That's where my responsibility and
so
accountability
it's to the
goes.
To the presence of the Savior, to the manifestation of God.
Yep.
Within us, so around us. Someone else from me?
Well, you know, New Age people have little shrines. And see, that's exactly the reaction I have. And it's like when I hear about, you know, anybody else's shrines, I'm very respectful. And when I hear about New Age, or I see a New Age shrine, I tend to like want to, oh, you know, like accidentally kick it or
spill your coffee.
You know, and I don't know why, you know, and it's usually little crystals and rocks and things. And, you know, I'm just wondering, because I think I'm not alone in that kind of, and I'm just wondering.
No, you're not.
Why I have such a cynical reaction to that stuff.
Well, I think, you know, my reaction to it, you know, I mean, okay, I respect them if they want to be spiritual, but I think, of course I respect them, but I think what irks me to it is because they borrow so many traditions from Native Americans and they give no credit. You know, I don't see their way of life changing towards us in any way, but yet they borrow our tradition, our mythology, our, you know, and they make use of it, which is fine, but, you know, we have to transcend it to the real level, I feel, you know. So that's my reaction to the New Age. It's great that they use all the elements of the earth, but where is it coming from? You know, if you look at this, all these things that's being borrowed and not really given credit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well put. Yeah.
Well, and I think what Anna Marie said about the remembrance, I mean, when you go and give the example of the Ark of the Covenant, these are symbols of something that happens, and that, you know, the word we all stumble at when we sing the hymn about, and now I raise my Ebenezer, and every time you think it, sing it, you think, why do they put a footnote in? I can never remember what that is. And it's the stone of remembrance. Mm-hmm. It's like a landmark that you put up and say, I remember that God helped me. And I think part of my reaction to that New Age stuff is it doesn't seem connected to anything. Mm-hmm. No, it's just
New.
Right. It's just new. Yeah, it's like you bought it somewhere. Let's go buy some stuff.
It's almost like phony. It really is part of that traditional history of that thing that will be passed down through oral history, through tradition, through example that all of us have learned from different cultures, you know?
It fits American consumer thought, too, and reading a lot about Mormons lately, too, that let us become our own God. Let us make God in our image. I'm going to customize my own God, and you know, a lot of the New Age thought philosophy of quote spirituality is no more than my desire to be my own God and goddess, and not have it. You know, I'll shape this and decorate it, and you know, go out and buy it, and you know, make something that I can be in charge of and control of, you know, and not understand.
But I wonder if that's what's becoming of religion to a certain extent. I mean, I don't know. Are we becoming so global that, you know, like the New Age, they're going to borrow principles of Buddhism and Shintoism and Christianism and Native American and then create a new thing? Is that what? And create a new God?
Sure. In our own image, hopefully. You know, consumeristic 20th century God.
21st century.
Cool. Yeah.
Last night when I was talking about hospitality, I mentioned that as a practice, you become wiser as you live it and practice it. You become wiser about what is the authentic expression of hospitality and extension of hospitality. And I think in some ways, we have to do some stumbling through before we find out, you know, in the practice of trying to make God present in our daily lives, what is the authentic? And it has to also be at a conscious level. I mean, it can become a practice that moves into a habit, which is good, the habit of the heart. But at the same time, there are moments where you have to pause and reflect and kind of reassess and reposition yourself. The other thought that I was having about home altars is I just met a woman at Emory while I was there who has been a real estate broker for 20 years. And she says it's incredible when you walk into someone's home, you know what their home altar is in a broad sense. She says she's walked into homes where walls have been covered with family pictures, you know, the ancestors, if you will, and the children, and such love and care put around those areas. And there are other places where people will have positioned all the newest stereo and CD and everything else. And you have to ask yourself, is that where their heart resides? Is that where their attention is? So it's almost as if we were to give ourselves a little examination of thought and consciousness and what we do to think, what are the important centers of the home? Like, where are our little sacred spaces? Where are our home altars, if you will?
In general, I think Kevin, Protestants sort of gotten away from from using a statue of setting aside a place. I don't think, an objection against
That's the thought, although the my colleague at Valparaiso, you had mentioned the Solomon, thinks there's a whole tradition, really, of Protestant iconography that just hasn't been attended to. The Solomon painting is the most widely reproduced religious image in the history of the world. I mean, several billions of these things in every conceivable size. And he's done a study of different Protestant homes and will find, typically, the Solomon painting or the one that you mentioned. There are several favorites among Protestants that help to concentrate their sense of the presence of God. And so it's really more, and especially what you just mentioned, yes, the Bibles out on stands or something like that. Yeah. So there really is it's not nearly as rich and aesthetically powerful and profound as Catholic cultures. But it tends to be more spare and simple, but it's nonetheless pretty pervasive.
Well, and there is that iconoclastic impulse in the early Protestant tradition that you get rid of those things because God is transcendent, not immanent, and there's always that tension. Terry had spoke in his Bible study this morning about, and I was trying to remember where the passage was, about why you don't make graven images because they have eyes but don't see and ears but don't hear and all of those things. And then the wonderful part at the end, you don't do that because if you have gods like that, you will become like that. So if you have gods who can't respond, you will become so that you can't respond. It's the tension always that when there's something that mediates, the temptation is to focus on the mediator, not on, to focus on the memory of the favor granted rather than on the one who granted the favor. On the other hand, we know that when we want to remember someone who we're parted from, we want their picture. We want letters from them. We wear their sweater or, you know, whatever it is, something that gives us, we're tangible, incarnate persons who live in a material world, and so of course we long for material, tangible things that connect us to what we cannot see. So I think there's that tension there historically and in contemporary practice.
Reminds me, Zach and I were having a conversation last night, which jogged my memory about another kind of a home altar, if you will. In Millbrae, California, which is 5 minutes from the San Francisco airport, not too long ago, in May, there was an incident of the killing of a policeman who had stopped a car that didn't have the necessary license identification and pulled him off the road. And while he was pulling him off the road, the man pulled out a gun. So the policeman radioed for help, and the second policeman came up on a motorcycle, attempting to help his worker friend. And as he pulled up, he was facing the suspect had his back toward him, and he called out, to call his attention to the fact that he was there rather than shoot. Well, when he did that, the man turned around and shot him and killed the second officer. It was the place where he was pulled off was the exit, one of the exits from the 101 freeway onto a mill break area. And at that site, they closed it off for like 5-7 hours until they could do all the investigation. And interestingly enough, the last time I went by there, there's a cross position right there at that exit with flowers and with his name. And so now this is like a constant reminder of someone giving his life to protect another individual. And it's interesting because that kind of crosses on the side of the road, I see more in more frequency in a Latin American country. It's what happened at the place where Rutilio Grande, who was the Jesuit that was killed in Central America, where he was killed alongside an older catechist and a young boy who was accompanying them. On the side of the road, they placed three crosses, and that's signals to people going along that road that that's where Rutilio Grande, the older catechist, and the young boy were killed. And it's a reminder, you stop, you say a prayer, you pray in memory of those who were killed, and in memory of what it represents and signifies. So I don't know, some, but you had some examples.
Well, I've noticed that a lot, because growing up and making treks into Mexico, we used to see them all over Mexico, but never in the U.S.
It's in Montana.
Now all of a sudden they're everywhere in Arizona, and they're not just by people of Mexican heritage, but like you say, to police officers or anybody else from any other cultural heritage, they've taken this tradition and are enacting it in their own communities. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I just read an article the other day where I think it was New Mexico, that, or maybe Texas, I'm not sure, has outlawed saying that there are distractions to motorists. Whereas to me, when I see them, you know, I say a little prayer and I slow down.
Yeah, that's right. better than those, every 2 miles now there's a sign that said, so-and-so gave money so this road can be clean. But now there are these signs every 2 miles.
Visual
pollution.
Exactly.
There's one, it's near Cuernavaca in Mexico, there's like this hairpin curve coming
La
down
pera.
The mountain. What?
La pera.
Is that what
the pear, because it's the pear, hair, like call it hairpin, they call it the pear.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And many people were killed on this hairpin curve, so they erected a shrine there to Our Lady to protect the motorists. And of course, now the deaths have been reduced tremendously because everybody slows down to look at the shrine to the Virgin.
Yeah.
It worked, and so. They're saying, we don't know if it's because she's protecting
the cross. Because we watch her.
In remembrance.
We would say she's a protection in battle. So being a protection at that curve. But Sanfo also mentioned that, and I think it's an interesting thing to think of, in contemporary society, how do youth deal with the need for remembrance of special people or of pleading toward God? And he was mentioning how in gang areas, where there's violence, death by violence, and it's true. I mean, I know in my own neighborhood, young people who have been killed in gang-related situations, the next day, or that very same afternoon, there will be graffiti on the wall in the name of the person who died. and it's a constant reminder to the other neighborhood youth of who died and to stop and pray or
yeah, and I don't know where all these folks are from, but in predominantly in the Southwest, you have a phenomenon happening with these inner city kids. They're not necessarily gang kids, but they're all classified as gang kids, just by the way they look, the way they're dressed, by the teachers, the schools, the police, they categorize them all the same. But when this whole gang thing started happening, another phenomenon happened. They started writing the names of their lost loved ones and putting them on t-shirts in memory of so-and-so, in memory of so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And this was all done in old English lettering. Mm-hmm. Now, the old English lettering goes it was just a style that was adopted by Mexican-American mm-hmm. youth. And, of course, because it was an expression of them, they gave it a gang connotation. We think old English means gang. How that works, I don't know. But anyway, then they started wearing t-shirts of La Virgen de Guadalupe and of Jesus on the cross, and with all this religious Catholic imagery, and that was an expression of the loss as well, of family and relatives. Now that has a gang stigma. Now they can't even wear shirts with La Virgen de Guadalupe or a picture of Jesus Christ, because that represents gangs. It's unbelievable how things are
and
twisted.
As you say that, I'm also reminded, you can think of youth in the Mexican neighborhoods, Mexican-American neighborhoods, as transforming their cars into portable altars, home altars. Because in fact, what they do have is a statue of Our Lady Guadalupe or a cross, and you'll see all this imagery within the confines of the car.
Oh yeah, and even images, Christian imagery painted on the cars, very elaborately, at great expense.
So the Ark of the Covenant, and it's portable.
The Ark now can go 110.
It's
contemporary
portable.
I think it's kind of an interesting thing to continue to think about. Let me just perhaps ask you, yesterday for some of you who were at the other session, I said that today we have a little example of a home altar, and if you wanted to, you could bring something that had special significance to you. So I don't know if any of you did, but Carmen did. Carmen, did you want to say?
Well, to me also home altar represents making something special for, like paper flowers, or we have a tradition of paper cutouts, and I couldn't get anything here, but I bead, and I bead bracelets, and sometimes I feel like my beading is a healing, because I'm quiet, I'm meditating, and I'm weaving my thoughts, my feelings within my work is a fruit of my labor. So when she asked me to bring something to the altar this morning, the only thing I could think of that would be of significance to me or a sacrifice of an offering were my bead work. So I put two bracelets there to show if our home I had not only bracelets but curtains made out of bead and flowers and paper cutouts and other things.
And I brought this Guadalupe image is the only one I had. She's portable. The other one that I have at home is the size of an entire wall. Like 6 feet tall almost, I think. But for us in the Hispanic, primarily the Mexican community, but also in the Latino community, she's a symbol of great hope for us and a great compassion and resurrection from suffering, which is situated in the historical event of 1492 for us here. That was native to this country. And I will be talking about Guadalupe next week. She's important to me, and I placed her there. And I also found rocks and bark and signs of nature, which does remind us of God's blessing us with the beauty of creation and the beauty of life. And the candle can be thought of in many different ways. Sometimes it's just a quiet reminder of God's presence in the I don't know if it's true in the Protestant tradition, but in the Catholic tradition, in the church, we have the Eucharist present in the sanctuary, and there's a light, and the light's a reminder that there is a presence. But it's also true, I think, in the Old Testament, there was the light, the tabernacle light. So that can be that. It can mean many things to different people. Sometimes it's just a quiet point of like meditation, kind of directing your thoughts, quieting.
When you talked about Posadas yesterday, and I shared with you, when I served rural congregations, we never locked the church. It was always available. And, you know, the one of several rural congregations I served at Balsamon, annual meetings, you know, the congregation. Should we save, because it was about $1 a week to buy the 7-day candle in, yes. Should we save the $52? And when your total budget's $12,000 for the year, $52 is a significant part. We could wire in a little nightlight bulb, you know, and we could do that all for about $10, you know, it's a little kit, you know, and get a bulb. And then the clicker is, you know, to get one of those bulbs that tries to simulate a flame, you know, and voted down, and I'm glad, and the Holy Spirit probably was so insulted by that, right? That it moved in the hearts of all these Swedes, and that, you know, and one older lady says, no, she says, all these years since we've had the vigil light, or the Christ candle, and different names people call it, when I come here alone, and, you know, in the winter, it's 20 below zero, and they're preparing for the church the next day to turn the thermostat on, or whatever needs to happen to prepare for worship the next morning. She says, I'm a little afraid because the wind is blowing, and this church sits out up on a hill, and the next home is a quarter mile away. And she says, all fear vanishes as soon as I see that flame. She says, I don't think an electric light bulb would do the same thing. and you know, these practical things, but it never was voted out to spend $52, you know, each year to purchase that 7-day candle, so that that flame was always present. So it took on a little different meaning than maybe not a Eucharistic meaning, but the presence of God, which Eucharist is. And it was for Lutherans, you know, Christ in and through these gifts continues to be. Now, you know, I serve a suburban congregation, and darn if there isn't a light bulb in the thing. And it's not, I mean, there's many other battles to fight, so I'm not going to enter into that one at this point in time, but a flame, a real flame.
There is something about this use of symbols, use of real, concrete things that we have that do draw our thoughts, draw our attention, focus us in one way or another. Let me just perhaps end by suggesting that all of us give some thought to sacred spaces that we might give attention to within the home, within the household, and how that can be a place where stories can be told, of God's goodness and God's presence and God's compassion and God's intervention on our behalf in moments of need, in moments of blessing as well, in moments of joy. And many of the things that we not only ask for, but we give thanks to God for. And that, I think, developing that kind of practice makes us more God-conscious, makes us more thankful for the sacred, for the divine, and helps us develop that kind of consciousness, that kind of understanding, that kind of directedness, if I can put it that way. So,
great for a young child. I think that family altar is great for a young child, who the altar has become the computer and the video games almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We give a special room for that. We give a special place for study. Why not a place where they can have a special feeling and bring part of them and touch and feel, because they don't have that much anymore.
I was going to mention the Advent wreath out of the, I don't know if it was German or Swedish, but the custom of that, and especially in those northern climates where it's dark. I mean, it's dark. We went to Norway at Christmas 2 years ago when our son was studying over there, and having lived in North Dakota, where I thought the days were short enough in the winter, to experience that it does not get light in Oslo, does not get light until 10, and it's getting dark at 3 o'clock. You know, and that Advent wreath takes on a real special emotion as the light gets brighter, and then finally on Christmas Eve, you know, you light the Christ candle in the center. those kind of things that we've tried to preserve. Mm-hmm. That's good year round, but we do look at that in Lent.
Yes, but just focus.
I wanted to share something that I heard the other day on NPR public radio. It was this community that was Hispanic that had the tradition of home altar was sharing their tradition with a community of elderly and even who were facing the death of their loved ones, and how they were feeling like, even though there was no traditional home altar, the fact that they were able to put the picture of their deceased one as a remembrance, they came to a closure of that loss, and they were able to heal themselves from those wounds. And I see that as a contribution that we can make to a larger society. In Arizona, my husband and I are responsible for starting the Daily Dead. We do it as a festival because we're artists and we like to celebrate life. We want to remind people to celebrate life, celebrate their people. And we are swamped by people who come and thank us for giving them an opportunity to grieve in a community-wide setting. Mm. And we do have a community altar. And by the end of the day, it gets filled with pictures. And we, at the end of the night, do a prayer. But when you're talking about home altars, I see that not only for the children, but also for the elderly. To be able to deal with closure and be able to deal with loss makes it so much easier if they feel like they've put their picture. Because a lot of, there was a story of a lady that lost a child and they never talked about it. It was like a taboo in their family. When they finally came out, and the other children were asking about the little brother that they kind of heard but didn't really know much about it, it became more of a healing thing. They put pictures of this child and toys of this child that passed away at age 3, and the whole family were able to deal with that in a much healthier way.
I try to teach Spanish to 7th and 8th graders. It's a wonderful experience, but one of my most favorite times of the year is when I talk about El Día de los Muertos. Mm-hmm. And as a Christian, it gives me a door that opens up to be able to talk about these things in a cultural sense, but I can also talk about it as a Christian. And it is fantastic to see the lights of hope go on for some of these kids that have no exposure at all to a loving God or to a God at all. And talking about family relationships and the hope in that and establishing that and what all this means, and it's fantastic. And I have lots of kids, when I ask them to write comments down afterwards, the usual comments are, I don't have to be so afraid of death, mm-hmm. because I will be remembered. Mm-hmm. And they talk about the Anglo culture where you don't talk about death, mm-hmm. it's all hidden. And this frees them, and then also they come up afterwards and we can talk about other issues of faith that are just, it's fantastic.
Next week, one of the sessions will be death, including Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, and also the whole practice of the novena in the Hispanic culture after the burial, which I'm thinking of in a phrase I heard the other day from a friend, the extended goodbye. And what that does.
Well, this closure garbage that we've been hearing, you know, 3 days, get over it. You know, closure.
Life goes on.
And Thursday, I will talk about sacred places, and I will show part of a video on, you may be familiar, this place in New Mexico, the sanctuary of Chimayor, which is considered to be a very sacred place. But the importance of sacred places. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just Lutheran home in Everett, Washington. I came out here to Lutheran home up in Everett, and one of the things that money had been set aside for was a specific worship space, even though it had to be shared for many other functions. But I think the same gentleman who might have done Joseph and Mary and baby used yesterday, I think that was Ernst Schwitter who did those too. Mm-hmm. Ernst is in Tacoma, and very definite, without putting eyes and things, but you know immediately. And actually, it's Bethany Holmes. So what he chose was Jesus with Mary of Bethany, not the mother, Mary. Mm. But we had a woman of French extraction, a Roman Catholic lady. And every morning when I would come, chaplain, I would do the opening devotions from the chapel. And there'd be a little flower or somehow, you know, crammed in Ernst's work there, but she was coming to venerate that, because in her mind that was the Blessed Virgin, and I wasn't about to tell her, you know, 96-year-old lady wheeling in there in her chair and she's putting a daffodil or something in there, and I wasn't going to tell her that that's Mary of Beth and you have the wrong Mary.
Well, for her, it was Mary.
Yeah, and she needed that, and she and that was her, part of her ritual, mm-hmm. to get out of bed, barely make it to breakfast, and then come first venerate, then go and eat, and that made, you know, made her day, made it bearable, you know, to die, you know, there.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a very rich discussion and exchange.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.